You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Comedy Cellar show here on the back table of the Comedy Cellar. My name is Noam Dworman. As always, I'm joined by Mr. Dan Natterman. Hello, Daniel.
How do you do?
And we have some pretty fantastic guests tonight. Jim Norton is a New York City-based stand-up comedian. He may be seen performing regularly at the Comedy Cellar. His new stand-up comedy special, Contextually Inadequate, is available on his website, jimnorton.com.
No, my new one is Mouthful of Shame. It's on Netflix. That's an old one.
Oh, my God.
Who wrote that up?
She did.
Oh, no, you missed one. missed the special.
But you can still see Contextually Inadequate.
Yes, you can.
At jimnorton.com.
You can.
All right, Perry.
You can binge watch both specials.
Stephen Calabria wouldn't have made a mistake like that. Anyway, and our guest of honor is Anthony Cumia, is the co-host of the wildly popular Anthony Cumia Show on compoundmedia.com, though he is most well-known for his legendary Opie and Anthony show. His book, Permanently Suspended, is available now.
Thank you, Noam.
Welcome, Anthony. So let's get right to it. Keith said you'd be available to join us, and I said, is it no holds barred?
Oh, yeah, obviously.
And he did say it was no holds barred. So let's just start with the incident. I'll just preface.
Just don't talk about race or profanity.
Actually, I'm just going to let you start. So you want to recount the incident that
spelt my demise on satellite radio.
Yes, and then we can talk about it because everybody wants to know.
I was out one evening in Times Square. I had a brand new Canon camera with a giant lens on it. And Times Square is just an amazing place to take pictures at 4 a.m. It still looks like the city, but no one's in the streets. So I was snapping a bunch of pictures, and a woman was in frame of, you know how they have the scaffolding set up on the sidewalks, and it was a great long shot through scaffolding with the lights and the buildings. So I'm snapping that, and she's walking through it, and she hears, because the Canon's pretty loud. It's, you know, a reflex camera. So she turns around and goes, oh, no, you ain't taking pictures of me. So I was like, I'm not. I'm taking pictures of this. She goes, don't take. And she runs toward me and wanted me to delete. I guess she thought it was a digital picture, and she wanted me to delete it. And I said no. She threw some racial epithets. She was a black woman. She threw some racial epithets at me.
Like what?
A cracker, white motherfucker.
Well.
Which I am. I'm white.
The word fits.
I am a motherfucker. I am part Sicilian, so I don't know how that white thing fits in. You know, the Moors did so much. So it became physical. She smacked me in the face. I was trying to protect my camera and myself from being hit. I walked away from the situation. It got heated at the moment. I didn't know quite what to do. I am a Second Amendment person. I had all the legality to carry a weapon in New York City, which I had on me, but never, ever even had an inkling of using it or anything. I didn't feel like my life was ever in danger. It was just an annoying thing that happened to me. I was being assaulted by somebody for absolutely no reason. I then walked away from the situation, went to my apartment.
Did she hit you?
Yes. Smacked me in the ear, open-handed, left a nice ringing for a while, and then smacked me in the face a few times.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know who this was, where she was coming from, what she was doing. She was very nicely dressed in a tight black dress kind of a thing, but I have no idea where she came from or why she was that angry that I was taking pictures, and she might be in frame in New York City. Times Square, by the way, a little trivia, the most photographed place in the world.
Hmm.
So it's not like I was doing anything completely out of the ordinary, but I'll go into the rest of it. I went to my apartment. I have an apartment here in New York City. And I figured the best way to get through this anger that I had was to tweet about it. So I went on and
Now, had you been drinking?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's 4 a.m. What the fuck am I doing out?
Wait, who takes pictures of scaffolding sober?
were you all...
No, I was... Me and Artie Lang were totally sober.
You were significantly drunk, over the legal limit?
No. I had a few drinks. I was doing all right, but the pictures were in focus, I think.
All right.
So it wasn't... Yeah, I went to my apartment. I figured I would tweet about it. And I had tweeted a lot of just over-the-top stuff over the years. I had done it on the ONA show. People knew my type of diatribe and humor. A lot of it was under the context of being funny and outrageous and what have you. And it did involve sex and race and cultures and whatever. And I had done that and made a damn good living off of it for many years. I went back to the apartment. My biggest mistake, as I see it today... And in reflection, was to try to add some type of social commentary to my being angry. It's not a good time to try to rationally spell out problems that I saw in society while you had just minutes earlier been assaulted and you'd had some drinks in you. So I did tweet things that I probably should not have tweeted. I think they obviously were insensitive to a larger group of people when I should have been focusing on an individual.
Right.
But I went off, and I was mad, and I was pissed. And I still to this day think, rightly so, I was mad. But I displaced that anger and spread it out with a wider brush. What got me in trouble.
Your one tweet in particular, you said that there was a problem of violence in the black community. Is that...
Yeah, I did post that. And in some respect, it was nothing more or less than I've heard a lot of clergy, law enforcement say that there is a problem that needs to be addressed. And I was reiterating that, saying, yeah, there is a problem that needs to be addressed. I would rather have had a conversation with this woman and said, hey, do you want me to delete it? Hey, why is there a problem? Whatever. But it instantly went to violence. It went to physical violence. And that got me thinking, again, about... a broader issue that there is a problem with. I don't think anyone can really deny some of the issues, but I could have been a lot more diplomatic, a lot more less stereotypical about it. I understand that.
So let me ask you. So, yeah. And this is what led to my falling out is not the right word. Where you and I cut ties with you for a number of years, because there was one tweet where you said I called her a, and then you use like garbage characters like a quotation mark, exclamation mark, whatever. But it spelled out the N word.
Right.
And that to me actually was the only tweet which I felt crossed the line. Mm-hmm. You have any comment on that tweet? Like,
yeah. Well, again, it was that painting with a wide brush.
Was this a Liam Neeson type feeling that you were having?
Not
in the sense of wanting to beat the shit out of somebody's
black. No, he was in Schindler's List.
No, in the sense that you Liam Neeson described having this rage against all black people because somebody black had done something.
No, it wasn't even against all black. It was still directed at her at that moment. The use of, and again, I never used the word.
No.
But everyone kind of knew what I was saying.
I mean, if somebody said I called him a kike because he, and then but he did, they just didn't spell out the word, but everybody knew. I say, well, I'm not gonna give him a pass for that.
In that much trouble, I'm teasing.
No.
The problem is when you are viscerally angry at being assaulted or whatever happens, something pretty traumatic happens to somebody. I've never been from the school of thought where you, as a person, have to take it down one notch of full anger. I was full anger at that point. So was I going to say things that were unbelievably offensive out of that anger? Yeah, I did.
But well, what is it? Because, I mean, believe me, the last thing I ever want to be is holier than thou about anything because I'd forgive anybody almost anything. Mm-hmm. So what I'm about to say is it just happens to be, in this case, about me. I had like really, really, really bad, horrible fights with like black people, musicians, working, whatever it is. I never felt that urge to the N-word. What do you think? Why do you think that is? Why do you think that you feel it?
Well, it was, I've had plenty of bad experiences with black people, white people, what have you. And with black people, I've never thought of using that word under that. But with the assault part of it... Mm-hmm. I couldn't get that out of my head at that moment.
It's just
that
human.
Was the limit. That was the line. It wasn't somebody bumping into me. It wasn't looking and having being offended by something someone said. That would do. It was that was my limit. Being physically assaulted for nothing. That made me go to 10 or in Spinal Tap 11.
Do you think that tweet crossed the line?
At the time, I did not think it did. Now, like I said, I could have and should have done things differently. Of course, yeah, yeah.
Because do you think if you would have apologized at the time or said, "Listen, I was mad." See, the stuff about violence in the black community. I mean, this is maybe considered politically incorrect, but you could justify it factually and otherwise. But a racial slur is a racial slur. Do you regret not apologizing for that?
And again, at the time, no. And another thing was, we had been in a time where this was happening on a daily basis to other people. A whole bit on the O&A show, and the lovely and talented Mr. James Norton can attest to this, we were talking about the bullshit apology.
Right.
And that is, whenever something would happen, someone said something, the very next day, suddenly, amazing, they got caught or in trouble for it. And immediately, for some reason, they feel differently. Yeah. They think completely differently. They would never have said that. And they apologize from the bottom of their heart.
Yeah.
It's dishonest. It's self-serving. It's nothing but trying to hold on
it's a hostage video.
To their job. It's a hostage video. Yeah, they have the newspaper, the guns to their head. And
but that doesn't mean one can never actually sincerely be sorry about something. You know?
Yeah, maybe after some real thought could be done, but that knee-jerk next-day apology is always bullshit. I will always say that's bullshit. If you get time to think about it, but that's just it. No one gives people time to really reflect on what they said and what they meant. They need an apology the next goddamn day or you're out. And sometimes you even apologize and you're out.
Megyn Kelly apologized. They still fired her.
Yeah, they still fired her.
It's usually written by lawyers, too.
The apology is such crap. So I don't believe that we've ever heard a sincere apology from people when they get jammed up like I did. But if given the time to reflect on it and really think, and I think time had a lot to do with how I feel about it, because I was kind of at the beginning of this whole thing, if you want to call it political correctness, if you want to call it an awakening, whatever it is, I didn't see that it was that big a deal at the time. And as the years now have gone on and we've seen more people confronted with this, I have a better understanding of what it's all about. So I can't even be dishonest in saying that I don't think there isn't a self-serving part of it. There is.
Right.
I think with everyone that apologizes, they're just trying to hold on. Look at this goddamn guy in Virginia. I mean, he's tap dancing, scrambling his ass off, trying to figure out how not to lose his job.
Right. What do they call slaves? Employees?
Yeah.
What a fucking idiot.
Yeah, it's one of those situations, though, where there's a sense of survival and self-preservation in what you're saying. But if you give enough time to it, you get an actual understanding of things, and you're able to more accurately reflect on what had happened.
Yeah, I mean, I believe if you gave truth serum to that guy Northrum, you would find that he would say, I didn't have any bad intention at all. It was a time I saw people, you know, and I just did it. He's not really sorry because...
Yeah, I don't think he is.
But how can you be sorry for something that you didn't think was wrong with it? But he's going to apologize. But in your situation, if you look back at it and say, no, actually, in anger, I attacked somebody for their color instead of for who they were, and that's not something that anybody's proud of.
Right.
So maybe the apology would be more easy in that situation.
But it is difficult at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe it is a kind of a testament to how imperfect, and Jimmy can attest to this too, imperfect a person I am.
We all
I disagree.
Are. We all
with the person part.
So difficult, though, to do. It is not an easy thing to do the right thing at times. You really do want to just lash out. I'm a very emotional person that I don't think a lot of people really grasp that, but I am. I tend to go off the top of my head, and I think that's helped me in entertainment and comedy especially, to just throw stuff out there without thinking of it. But other aspects of your life, it can be detrimental.
Are you carrying at this time?
No, I will even say no, Keith is.
I am.
Yeah. Yeah. When I walk around with Keith, I don't have to carry.
Now, you have to, just really quickly with regard to that, if somebody attacks you, you have to, in New York State, you have to run away if you can, right?
And that's something an armed person wants to do. Like a real person that has a responsible a person that has a license to carry a firearm will do everything in their power to get away from the situation, especially in a state like New York where you are held liable if you don't try to escape. There's laws that say you need to retreat.
You can't stand your ground law.
No, stand your ground is Florida and some other states where they say if you're attacked, you go for it.
New York,
in New York, even in your own house, in certain counties and the city of New York, you have a responsibility to, even in your house, continue to retreat if it's available to you. So, and you could be charged with at least manslaughter.
But you know, dead men tell no tales.
That is true. I remember hearing the story as a kid all the time. It's like, if you got to shoot someone out in your yard, make sure you throw them through the window after you're done. Because it's like, yeah, I've watched enough Forensic Files. I don't think that'll work. Why is there this pool of blood on your lawn? And then, yeah.
So now, Jim, you were a partner on the show at the time. It was called Opie and Anthony, but really, Jim was
partners in life.
It was really a 3-man operation. Correct?
Yes, it was.
And so, what were you feeling about this at the time?
When it happened, it was awful. I my ex girlfriend called me, and
his first call was to his accountant.
Yeah, and I'm like, hey, I think you get me a little raise. It doesn't look good. No, my ex-girlfriend called me, and she goes, what happened with Anthony? I'm like, I don't know. And she's like, he got beat up by some
quotes
lady?
Quotes on girl for girlfriend, oh, by the way.
Yeah, she called me, she fucked my mouth, and then we laughed about it. So, no, I wound up, I actually got a call from Hannity. He called me, I was at Bob Kelly's house, and Sean Hannity called me. And he goes, what the fuck is Anthony doing? This was like the second day.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know, man. He's having, because I think you and I had spoken. And he goes, give me his number. He's got to take that stuff down. So Hannity, that's why he called you. He called me to get your number. And, you know, I guess you took them down.
Yeah.
But by then, Sirius had kind of made their decision.
Yeah, that's how bad it got. Sean Hannity called me to tell me to calm down.
So were you angry? You felt let down? Did you try to get him to apologize? And if I'm crying, don't...
Tell me whatever you want.
I'm trying to ask what I think would be...
I just talked about my face getting fucked. You're not crying.
No, I was like, if I was hearing this interview, these are things I've always been
anything
wondering.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, I was frustrated because, like, I love Anthony, and I just knew that it was over. I knew. Like, as the days went on, we had a vacation there, so they had plenty of time to think about it. We couldn't remember. Yeah. I think we were on 4th of July vacation. So it was a very hard, because I just knew that this amazing thing we were doing was done. And that was the frustrating part, was knowing that this comedic collaboration, like, you'll never communicate with a funnier person in your career than you have been for the last 10 years. So I was kind of looking at it from that point of view, of this this amazing back and forth, which was really, I mean, it was fun every day, was done. And that was the hard part of it. Besides, I knew my friend was out of a gig. So when he got
there was that, yeah.
No, but I mean, it was. But I thought I was going to get fired too.
Me. Oh yeah, him.
me. But you really think that you're going to get fired too? I didn't expect Opie and I to carry on, which we did, and we shouldn't have.
That was a great 10 minutes.
It really was.
But you guys didn't get along. Is that it? Or
no? I mean, we did at first. We tried. But again, you just try to pay your bills. And like, what am I going to do? It's a gig. But after a while, I just realized that we just didn't want to work together at all.
It was like the Connors after Roseanne.
Yeah, it was really bad. So we wound up not liking each other at all. We haven't spoken in over 2 years.
Well, you did get along well. Well, you were all three of you together. It's just when it was one-on-one that you didn't like
each
other.
At one point, we stopped getting along then. You know, me and Anthony always clicked and got along.
It was so much easier to walk into that studio every morning and know Jimmy was there, because I knew it was going to be 4 hours of us laughing our asses off about whatever. And Opie being there as sort of the technical producer of the show, push the buttons, go into spots, tell us when we need to break, whatever it was. But it was always me and Jimmy walking in there after Jimmy got on board. And that was literally 3 or 4 years after the O&A show started in Boston. So most of the O&A show was Anthony and Jimmy, and Opie kind of there to, as they always say, I hate to steer the ship, like the fucking White Star captain on the Titanic. But, you know, me and Jimmy always, every time I walked in there, I knew I was going to be having just a great time. And regardless of what mood Opie was in, we were still going
to
have fun.
Wait, there's things online. I can't listen to the old bits. I can't listen to Patrice on the show. It's just too difficult.
I like his new shit.
Yeah, I do too. The post 2012 shit is awesome. First time I've been able to finish a conversation with him.
It's just a red light over his coffin. Get off, stupid.
This thing's called the Jim Norton Laugh Compilations online. Mm. And it's things fans have done. And all it is bits that I'm laughing at. And it's all shit he said. So I'll go back and listen to that stuff because I'm literally just listening to him being funny
again.
You're
in the audience, yeah.
Yeah, so
we would
still
cry, like crying, laughing at stuff that was so like just funny as in a way that I've never been able to laugh with anybody else but Jimmy. Like there's a common humor there that some people wouldn't find funny.
Dan and I don't have that at all.
No, I'm sure.
It's a shared lack of humanity.
Yeah, and I'm sure Dan doesn't have that, who appeared in a pedophile bit that Jimmy did.
Oh, that's right.
With myself, by the way.
Is that still up there?
So I got one more question that I want to ask before Jim leaves. So you're in a club now of a group of prominent people who some deserved it, some maybe didn't deserve it at all. Who've been kind of slimed. And
yeah.
How do you think, can you ever get unslimed? How do you carry that with you?
It's tough at times. You feel like you want to blame somebody, but there's no one out there. And then maybe you have to be a little reflective and go, oh, boy, if I can't find someone to blame, perhaps the man in the mirror. That guy from the Gillette commercial saying he could be a better man.
Oof.
Yeah, I know. It's one of those things where you kind of have this self-guilt for doing that. But it also gives you an opportunity to move forward. I always said, like, if I didn't get fired when I did, I'd have been fired five more times after that. It's just the way I like to express myself, and I am. Perhaps not for the same thing, but I think especially in this day and age, you have to tiptoe around a minefield of things that you can't even address or talk about.
The jokes, a lot of that jokes that we were doing even at one point, we were just talking about that before, would have gotten us. We never would have been able to do half of the stuff we did in the 10 years would have gotten us fired after 2014.
Yeah, there were things about, I think some of the hardest I ever laughed was one of the most tragic events. It was the Lacey Peterson murder. Because we were shock jocks.
Jim is laughing now just thinking about it.
The barbarism of the jokes. They were horrible.
They were horrible. There's a part of humor I don't think people can really contextualize, that it's so evil and so mean-spirited that it becomes funny because a human being wouldn't say this stuff. And that, in some way, and I don't know where it comes from in our own humanity, is a funny thing. I don't know if it's nervousness, uncomfortability, but there's this humor in the macabre.
Well, it's also the extreme horrific nature of people is pretty funny. Ted Bundy, or Dahmer eating people. If you can't find humor in that,
sure.
But Louis got in trouble for exactly this with the Parkland jokes.
Right.
What did you think?
And yet, no one had a problem with the four-part Ted Bundy documentary on Netflix. It's nonsense. The comedian upset me, but I listened to the guy that raped and murdered a 12-year-old and smothered her in the mud.
He was handsome and charming, Jimmy.
Oh, that Ted, what a dish. They can't stop talking about how fucking handsome Ted Bundy is.
Was it Scott Peterson? Him too. He was getting
Scott Peterson.
Yeah, so that's the bullshit.
That looked gorgeous. What a doll.
Louis' jokes, they were tasteless, but Louis would tell you they were tasteless. But the fact that he had to deal with that the New York Times is not writing about why is there a Ted Bundy documentary. They're not writing about it in the Washington Post or in the LA Times, but they were all so angry at Louis for tasteless jokes.
Yeah.
Fuck them. No one's mad at Zac Efron. And I'm not talking about the families of the victims. Of course, they feel differently. But I'm talking about the press. No one's going to give Zac Efron shit, and he's going to play Ted Bundy accurately.
Another dish.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? He's going to show a rapist being a rapist, and he's going to get praised for that. But if you make fun of somebody getting shot, you're a bad guy.
I don't think he was, though. Enough people don't really...
I got to go on stage. Go ahead, Jim.
Okay, Jimmy. Look, braggart. I love that guy. I don't think people take into consideration the context of what they're people are saying and talking about. So when Louis said did a bit that involved the Parkland students, he got in big trouble for it because it's like all of a sudden the headline is Louis makes fun of school shooting. Now, Louis was saying, he was talking about the kids that became the spokespeople for the shooting. Now, he was making fun of them. It could sound like semantics. It could sound like you're just trying to make excuses. But no, this is what it was. He didn't say a shooting was funny. He said these kids that become spokespeople are stupid and shut the fuck up. Now, regardless of how you feel about that, there are levels of it. He's not going, ha-ha, kids were killed. He's saying, shut the fuck up, you're a dopey kid. I was one once, and I didn't know shit, so you probably don't either. I get that joke, and I don't think it's joking about a school shooting.
Yeah, I think the most controversial part of that joke was when he said that they pushed a fat kid in front of them.
Yes, that was a...
Because, well, some people perceive that as an accusation, but it wasn't a serious accusation. It was just...
No.
It was an absurdist comment.
Again, absurdist.
It was absurdist.
Yes.
And it did elicit a chuckle out of me, I must say. Although Noam, I think, felt differently about
that. That's always been a joke with plane crashes, a fat person in the emergency exit. This has been a joke over the years that has been used, and he used it in the context of a school shooting. Still, not making fun of the shooting itself. Again, am I just juggling with semantics here? I don't think so, personally.
Well, the audience seemed to be laughing. I mean,
dude, Louis could get up in front of a crowd and they will howl laughing at him. And the more he mentions his controversies, the more they laugh.
Right. And what I'm saying is that some, you know, it's difficult. I made this analogy afterwards. Like, if you took a recording of me having hot sex, and an audio recording, and then put it and played it for me during my morning coffee, like, what the fuck is that? It sounded like a crazy person.
That's good.
But yes. At the time, in context, it was perfectly appropriate. Yeah. You know?
Context is big. Context is everything.
So,
you're listening to something that sounds harsh of an audio recording of a comedy club late at night, drinking all that stuff. The time, it didn't sound that way. It didn't sound like a crazy person screaming. You know?
Another thing is this.
It's unreasonable to make an assessment without that context, yes.
You need that context.
You got to have it.
Another thing is a comedian working out bits is not supposed to be recorded and played as a thing. Think of like you get these cooking shows where you got a chef and he's doing stuff, and then someone pulls his thing out half cooked out of the oven, goes, "Ew, this sucks." That's what you're judging. He's not done yet. Comedians, I think, more than anyone else, need that latitude to offend people, to say things that are way off base, and then pull it back when they see the reaction, because the only way you can get an honest assessment of what you're doing is based on that crowd reaction. If you're being judged on that, and now comedians are afraid to put it out there, you are going to get such watered-down bullshit.
Can I give you an analogy?
Please.
I said to somebody yesterday. So, like, if I drew a line on the floor here, and I said, I want you to walk right up to the edge of that line but not cross it, you would walk right up to the edge of the line, and you might fall over it. Now, if I said the same thing about the edge of a cliff, you might not get within a foot of that cliff.
That's right. Yeah,
but
that's a good point.
Danger factor.
That's where all the good stuff happens.
Generally,
so if you're
going
to put a cliff where there just used to be a line, you lose your career,
that's
whatever
a great
it is,
analogy.
You're
going to
lose everything. You're going to lose the entire foot of the most important, interesting shit.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening now, not just in comedy, everywhere.
Yeah.
Where people say, I'm not walking, because if I don't have, there's no margin for error.
No, to get
I'm
near
not
the
going
line.
Off the cliff.
No, if it's too risky to get near the line, then you won't get the gold associated with getting near
now,
the line.
Fortunately,
I mean, what does that do to the culture, and what are the systemic effects of that kind
Fortunately, most comedians are hacks anyway, and they're not going to get anywhere near the line. Your average comedian has no desire to get within 100 miles of any line.
Yeah. Comedians
But for those few, those few brave souls that dare to approach that line or cliff, as it's becoming,
and those are the people that generally drive the art form forward, so to speak. Like the progressive nature of anything is that the change comes from the fringe. It comes through or by way of the edge.
Don't know where that line is, that people will revolt and go like, "Oh my God!" So you could pull it back.
Then
you're never going to get very close to
but
it.
But actually, I just want to revise slightly what I said. I think a lot of great comedians don't go near that line. I think Brian
Regan.
Is it
Regan. Different oh, yeah. Comedy. Go near the line. It's a different kind of comedy.
Did you say Ryan Reese?
No, did I say Ryan Reese?
You said Brian Regan.
I said Brian Regan. A lot of people are saying now it's a comedian's job to challenge conventional norms.
Certain types of comedy can be,
but you can also just be... Take my wife. Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but Ryan Hamilton or Gilbert Gottfried, who I love, but although he's been...
It's a good point that people think that there are comics out there operating at a high level that don't necessarily need to get near that line, but it's not apropos to the discussion.
Gaffigan doesn't get near
the line. Yeah, but it's not apropos to the discussion. The discussion is, what do we lose in a culture that doesn't allow you to get near the line?
It's not just comedy.
You know what it is, too? Like Pavarotti and Axl Rose, both considered singers, but you would never put them in the same category. Why do comics have to follow this thing where it's like, well, you're a comic, this generic kind of thing? There are comics that really do challenge the norm and go out there and push those limits. And I think they're doing a great service to society. But they're not being given the context they deserve. And they're being treated like they were a doctor or a lawyer or a politician.
To extend that analogy, what would happen if Copernicus were afraid to go near the line?
Who's Copernicus?
Catholic Church. Copernicus means
Copernicus,
the world,
babe.
No. How much longer would we have thought that the world were flat if he was afraid to continue to make an argument?
Go online. There
was
still people.
Was Copernicus the flat Earth guy?
Or was Galileo?
I think Copernicus was the
telescope.
Earth
who was
revolved
the Earth
around
flat?
The.
Or Earth revolves around the sun.
Was
either
he
way,
the flat Earth guy.
No, it's a good point. But either way, the point being that there's a truth that was brought about.
Yeah.
But in the face of a culture that didn't want that truth brought about, you're right. It was probably that we circle the sun as opposed to everything that circles us. Right. That was Copernicus.
It was either that or. More than two fingers is probably his penis. So that was a tell. That was actually David. That was David Tell. But here's the thing about comedy is it's the only art form also where you're expected to perform for whoever the fuck is sitting there.
Oh, what a great point.
You know, I mean, you wouldn't, if you were a fan of country music, you wouldn't go to see a rap show. You wouldn't go to see heavy metal. But whoever's coming here to the Comedy Cellar, we have to entertain them, so we have to be
a prostitute.
Yeah.
So you take it as they come.
But if you have a crowd of people that is very diverse in their ideology, and you're a comic that's up on stage, and they are all laughing, isn't that just funny? Can you then take what the comic's saying and bash it and say that it's inappropriate when you actually have a crowd of people that don't have much in common with each other laughing at that one commonality? You can't then say, well, that's terrible. It's a universal thing that now is making people that don't really share an ideology laugh together.
What you're saying is it's not off base necessarily if it's funny. Meaning if you can get everybody
there it is.
Absorbed in the story.
Then it's just funny.
It's just
go
funny.
Fuck yourself when it comes to ideology or how bad it makes someone feel or anything else. Yeah. It's funny, and it's been tested, litmus tested through an audience that really doesn't have much
in common.
It's
either balanced enough or absurd enough, regardless of how risky the material is, that everybody from all four points of the room is laughing.
Find it funny.
How bad could it be?
Well, also, if you're in Nassau County, though, the audience is going to be probably less diverse than it might be here in Manhattan.
Well, I live there. Oh, wait a minute.
I was going to say that in Louis's case is actually what they came to see Louis. It was an announced show.
Yeah.
So really, you have a private thing between Louis and the people who like the kind of stuff that he says.
Right.
It's none of anybody's business. It's like somebody saying, well, I heard at the comedian table between you and Dan,
do you think more people wouldn't go to see comedy fans in general, just a general comedy fan? Do you think more people would see Louis if they found out he was a mile away, or wouldn't see Louis because they're angry with him a mile away? I think people that just like funny would go see Louis.
Oh, yeah.
I think the people that staunchly wouldn't see him are a very small minority of people.
Well, if you begin screening ideas for things that may, in theory, hurt someone's feelings at some point, you will remove a lot of any culture, whether it's science, politics, sociology, or math. I mean, whatever you're talking about, how can you grow in a culture that prevents you from communicating that which you're thinking about or feeling?
You can't. Everybody needs a margin of error, and that's
a margin of error, for God's sake.
Yeah.
All right, what else?
Do we
what
want to talk about also...
how about this, this?
Well, Aziz was here the other night, and I just want to...
Aziz was here last night.
Was he? Well,
what about
all,
it?
All of a sudden... No, because I read on Twitter, it was trending. Aziz was on stage talking about the accusations of sexual impropriety
a year
ago. And of course, there's always only one winner whenever this kind of stuff happens, and that's Noam Dorman. Because... because the Comedy Cellar once again gets a tsunami of publicity because that took place here. So in every article, it says the Village Underground at the Comedy Cellar. So what Noam has done to deserve God's blessing, I don't know. Because he doesn't even believe in God, and yet God sees fit
to bestow upon
to throw him publicity.
Such generosity.
It reminds me of that. It was in a time this philosopher who was dying on his deathbed, riddled with cancer. This is a true story. He had his close people around him,
yes.
And he says, "Why is God punishing me this way? Is it because I don't believe in Him?"
So apparently Aziz talked about it, said he's learned a lot and he's grown from the experience. I don't know if you saw it or were there.
Interesting. When I read that, I thought they had publicized a lousy date. Like, to me, that wasn't really
that's
any
exactly
type of
what it was.
Harassment or anything. It was a lousy date. If he's a bad guy to go out with one night.
The news is I wanted head and wasn't interested in a long-term relationship. That's the fucking news now? Well, welcome to my dating life pre-45 years old. That's the story of my life. I want head, but maybe I don't want to take it that much further.
Yeah. Boy, is that why they cast you as that dude on Crashing?
Right?
Crashing this week. Dove is apparently... Who knew he had such a range, an acting range?
He had such a range. Yeah.
He was playing Nick Dice DiPaolo.
I didn't see the episode.
Hey, Dove plays a dude who... a creepy comedian who tries to bang a waitress. And then the waitress...
So he plays every comic.
I'm on Crashing, but they don't give me the meaty... I'd like a nice meaty role.
I'm hoping
if there's a season four that maybe I can... You know, spread my wings
you're
as an actor.
You're that constant background character.
Yeah, I'm at the table,
They had the sweat hogs in the front, and then they had Hotsy Totsy in the back. The red
I'm like
girl.
The guy, or in Cheers, like that guy Al. They had one line every five seasons.
Hey,
Diane, looking good. I don't get to be, normal.
You got to yell Norm when they all came.
I was
trying to be comedic, but the idea that can become news. A scenario where wherein the woman you were with or the man found something you did untoward, but not illegal. It wasn't genuine impropriety. The idea that
we don't know
the case.
What happened, but yeah.
Well, we do know what happened from her perspective, and we know what happened from his perspective, and nobody's accusing anybody of any crime.
No crime.
Or any genuine sexual harassment.
Untoward, we don't know. But no,
it was a consensual, awkward as fuck date.
Yeah, it was like, okay.
That's what it sounded like.
Can I just quickly say, Judd Apatow, if you're listening, I'm grateful to anything you give me. I don't mean to sound ungrateful. No, Judd listens to this, because he told me so.
And if awkward were news, Natterman would be on the cover of the Times on a weekly basis.
Can I ask you guys a question?
Well, sexually speaking...
Hold on. I want to ask a question. We can go skip right past it if it's not interesting.
You know, you want to hear his pickup line to a girl at the bar one time?
Yeah.
He gave her a piece of gum, and I said, Dan, buy her a drink. And he didn't. And then I bought her a drink. And then he turned to her. I said, you got to talk to her. And he looked at her, and he goes, that's a good chew, huh?
Did he close the deal?
Of course he did. He banged her dog style. No eye contact whatsoever. Gave her a piece of Wrigley's and didn't pay for the cab.
The story is quite funny, but not entirely accurate.
It's pretty accurate. The key points are accurate.
But it's funny, so that's all that matters.
I'm just curious. So
that's a good chew.
Netflix changed everything by giving us something that we all really wanted, which was the ability to binge watch. Yet HBO stubbornly refuses to let you binge watch their series that's already totally in the can. And I'm wondering why that is. They don't make more money when you watch it when it's broadcast. Why don't they? What are they trying to prove?
I guess the numbers count. And if you were able to binge watch, you could just never watch HBO again.
But I'm ready to get rid of HBO because it's too fucking frustrating. I'm used to that's the argument.
They want you there every week. I know. Believe me, I love being able to binge watch.
There's no commercial. I mean, I don't even want to invest in a new HBO series if I know I'm going to have to wait 3.5 months.
Blockbuster Video didn't read the tea leaves either, and we saw what happened to them.
It's like ice cream. If I can just have one spoonful a week, just keep your ice cream. I want the whole fucking pint.
You know, you think they might trial and error, you know, I always say is worth 20 IQ points. Why don't you try it with one series? Let them binge watch one series and see pilot program and see how that works.
That being said,
bad decision making.
That being said, in the 80s, we loved, you know, we loved our once a week, but maybe
we had
there's a weird camaraderie that comes with watching something when it's on live also, and that old school when you used to have to watch things when it was on, the next day you'd go into work and all discuss
it was a different
and it made
culture.
A buzz. And I
we haven't had that around here since your tweets.
I think that helps though. Like I think people talk about it when they see it. Isn't it odd? Like the Twilight Zone is available, or the Honeymooners, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I could get it on various services. But when the marathon comes on New Year's Eve or something, I'll watch it then. And if you look at Twitter or other social media or talk to people, they had this common thing where you all watched it together, and I think that there's some kind of societal bond when we watch these shows at the same time,
so
and then can talk about it the next day.
Natterman once had a really similar insight, not exactly the same, and I remembered it forever. I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah, radio.
The radio. You want to tell it?
Well, it was something like if you.
You said you were on a road trip and you made a playlist.
Yeah, you made a playlist, but when you heard a song that you didn't know was coming, it was that much more satisfying.
You said it was like masturbating. It's not the same when you do it yourself.
I don't remember having said that.
Yeah, you did.
I remember having done it.
Are we back to Louis?
It's better when someone else does it for you.
No, that's my joke about masturbating that I did on the Comedy Cellar.
Right,
show.
But you said it about the radio. It's like when the disc jockey plays the songs, it somehow it's better.
Yeah, but I don't recall comparing it to masturbation. Yeah, but in any case, when you didn't expect that song coming,
you don't need to disassociate yourself from something which was actually funny. By the way,
he does this all the time. You heard him trying ruin my. He tried to ruin my. That's a good chew story by saying that.
Because I believe
really
our listeners want
the comedic truth.
They want the truth. They rely.
They don't need a fucking court transcript. They want the general comedic truth.
But we got the best of both worlds because you got to laugh when you said
it.
I gave him the truth afterwards.
I can't wait to read the minutes from this podcast.
Let's be proper about the proper radio people.
You have
a book coming out called Permanently Suspended.
It's out. Yeah.
Jim's back. So tell us about the book.
Permanently Suspended.
Yeah, the book Permanently Suspended. Obviously, the name comes from my experience with social media and pretty much everything else in life, Sirius XM satellite radio, other radio jobs. I am constantly in a state of permanent suspension. It details kind of the story of the O&A show, myself and Opie having a relationship of 20 years in radio. And,
did you hold anything back? Were you totally frank
in this
book?
No, I blew it all out. I put a little bit of my earlier life and how I grew up so people might get an understanding
how did you
of
grow up?
How I was. Grew up, born and raised on Long Island until I was about 13.
Has he grown
13.
Up?
Yes, have I. And then my dad and mom got divorced, and my dad moved out to California, so I spent some time out there during my formative early teen years, and it was just a party. Like, my dad was one of the most irresponsible people ever. But he left New York because he wanted to be a cowboy.
Now, is he a guy who had racial attitudes? He did.
He was Italian American in the 50s.
Italian,
so.
New York, 50s. He grew up. So I heard a thing or two around the house. It was shocking at times.
But that creates wiring sometimes, you know.
I think it does. I think it's a combination of what you learn in your own experiences and whatnot that kind of mold who you are. But I think parental influence does have a lot to do with a lot of things,
you know who Anthony,
positive and negatively.
Anthony is to me. He's a kid. He had pleased to play with dolls. He would make these little puppets. He was this little creative, sweet boy, and his father shamed him and accused him of being a homosexual accurately. And he went the other way.
No blowjob tonight.
But I always think of Anthony as that creative little fucking kid.
He did. Once I made a puppet. I made a marionette. Mm-hmm. Out of paper towels and tape and whatnot. But I hadn't got to the point with the crossed wood and the strings yet. So my dad goes, "What is that?" And it's like, "It's a marionette." He goes, "No, it's not. It's a doll. You're not carrying a doll around." I was like,
"Oh,
no."
Wow.
And my mom was like, "Joey, don't be ridiculous. It's a puppet. It doesn't have strings. It's not." And they got into this ridiculous argument as to what dictates a puppet, a doll, and a
Well, you're either gay
so
or serious.
So I popped the dick out of my mouth, and I said, "Hey,
But a marionettist and a guy plays with dolls, so you're either a gay or you're a serial killer.
Yeah. My dad would have preferred the serial killer. Believe me. Yeah, so it was, you know, my dad was one of these very macho kind of horses. When we went out to California, it was all about cowboys. And, you know, we rode around with guns and hats and cowboy boots and cattle. It was the weirdest thing because it was Santa Monica. No, it wasn't. San Juan Capistrano.
And then you had a blue-collar profession for a while?
It was a tin knocker, they call it. Air conditioning and heating ductwork installation. And I was the hoot of the job site. Always making everybody laugh. I started getting into radio doing voices on. I would call up from my work van and I'd call Howard's show and do Sam Kinison impressions over the phone and whatnot.
Could we hear a little Sam? Man?
Yeah, always. I would call up and go, "Hey, Howard, how you doing, man?
Yeah, so I hear Jackie wants to come out to Vegas. Maybe we could do this, Vegas show, you know? If he wants money, though, I can't pay." You know,
we just go into the whole thing because it was like green money.
He
green
does
weight.
These impersonations. You think it was the real person?
The real people. Janice Rossi's a whore.
There's an impressionist in your building.
Yeah, so I thought, you know, there would be some way of getting my foot in the door of radio and entertainment. Even before I got into radio, I always wanted to be in it. I just always wanted, somehow it was the greatest job ever. I would go to job sites and not stop listening to Stern until sometimes 11 o'clock when he'd be off. And I'd have to finish the job in a couple of hours when I had the whole day because I could not stop listening to Stern. That influenced me huge. And then I got the opportunity to go on Opie's show with a few song parodies and whatnot. My brother had given Opie. And he said, "Can you come in and perform them live?" I'm like, yeah, I got my brother, and I was like spinning plates and juggling and just doing my best to be like, look, I could do all this. I'm doing impressions and riffing on the news. And he just said, "Can you come in maybe 2 days a week, or three?" And he was recording all these shows that we did, sent it up to a few radio stations. We got a call from Boston. They gave us the job, and I was like, I literally took my toolbox. I had a big toolbox full of tin knocking tools. And threw it out the window at 60 miles an hour on I-95 going up to Boston just say, that's it. I'm done with that.
He was driving in front of Harry Chapin.
That's awesome. That's an awesome scene in a movie.
Yeah, it was one of those things. It was a one-in-a-million shot. I never, and I've thanked Opie in my book for actually giving me that chance. I'm a construction guy.
Right.
And it's like, hey, be my equal on-air partner here up in Boston.
Thanked Opie for giving you the chance to be the best thing that ever happened to him.
That ever happened to him. Right, right. I made sure I brought my coat with the longest tails on it.
Jim, did you ever have a real gig or a real, like, career-type job?
Oh, wow, that is a little harsh. No, he's always been a piece of shit.
Well, I mean, other than, like, Anthony had an actual career.
Yes.
Yeah, the Tin Man.
I worked
tin
in...
Tin Man! Only he could say Tin Man.
I was just warehouse work. I was warehouse worker. Forklift driver. Before.
Where?
Fucking good.
So this is interesting to me. So you loved Howard Stern.
Yeah.
And then when you finally got there, he treated you badly, right?
Not really. No. To be quite honest, it was another one of these things where Opie had this horrific problem with Howard Stern. And I think it was based on pure jealousy. Howard was and always will be the cornerstone, the benchmark of what you could be in radio. And Opie always had a problem with that. So I had to go along with, like I said, I wasn't going to be Slash and Axel. I was pocketing a check, a huge check. So I wasn't going to fuck that up. So I'd be like, yeah, fuck him and fuck them. And then when we got to Sirius, I'd be in the elevator with Fred or Robin. And it was so cordial, so nice. I met Howard in Atlantic City. We were playing poker at different tables and shook
hands. He's playing the $5 table.
The guy was playing. It's in my book, Permanently Suspended. He's playing literally a dollar. I'm sitting there sweating with $100 chips. Like, yeah, how's that Hamptons house doing, you son of a...
Yeah, because he's doing it just for fun.
That was it. It was just... Yeah he's playing for fun. Yeah. I'm playing for mortgage.
You're playing to make money. Yeah.
You're playing for a childhood stolen.
By the Jimmy Norton Foundation.
Do you ever think of it from the opposite direction? That if you had a show where it was the Anthony Cumia show,
yeah,
and Jim was Fred Norris, and do you think you might have been even more successful? You know, if you didn't have not part of an ensemble.
Yeah, I think the way I got into it, and pretty late, I was in my mid 30s.
Still an
when
ensemble, but you know, the head of the ensemble.
Yeah. I think because I was in my mid-30s when I first got into it, like Howard was teens or something, you get to work your way up there. I never had the confidence until many years later to even think about doing anything on my own. I just wasn't confident in what I did. Even though people told me it was good and they loved it, I thought I needed to be at least second fiddle until I got fired and did the Anthony Cumia show. It was very difficult for me to have any kind of self-confidence. So
I think you have some of what... I've always thought this, because you're a great conversationalist. Not in terms of being funny necessarily, all of it. Just you're a great... You can keep a conversation moving. And that's... That's one of Stern's hugest talents.
Yeah,
in my
opinion.
You can just listen to him talk.
Always been great at that. Yep.
You know, he doesn't need to be funny, really. He just Chappelle has that. You can just listen to Chappelle for
you
half an
hour.
You
tell a compelling story. It's just fun to do. But
I have to go. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I have to go. I have to be somewhere to eat.
Okay.
So,
look at this busy guy.
I wanted to talk briefly about your Netflix thing, but okay.
Fuck it. It's okay. It's on Netflix. If you like, it's called Mouthful of Shame. Here's the thing I want to say about Anthony. Opie was really great as a teacher. And we work really well firing spitballs, like that childish, while something is happening, just fucking off in the back. And that was why I think we functioned so well. But after a while, Opie got, he was uncomfortable whether he admits it or not, and he wanted to be one of the ones shooting spitballs. And three guys shooting spitballs just doesn't work.
Yeah. Right.
He was amazing. When he was comfortable being the teacher, though, and chiming, he was great because he really knew how to run the show.
Yeah, there was a little animosity or jealousy or whatever you want to call it that came later when he started seeing, like, everybody loving what myself and Jimmy were doing. And then he's just sitting there kind of being the ringleader or being the guy that had to stop it because we had to go to commercial.
He felt left out.
He felt left out in those conversations and... You know,
I've seen dynamics like that in bands, but I'm not going to get boring about it.
I'll see you guys later. I got to run.
Take it easy, Jim.
I'll talk to you soon, pal.
Cool, man.
So this Keith Maraska, you know, he was you were a captain at the Sixth Precinct?
He was the guy that put the plunger in that guy's ass. He just got out of jail, I swear.
Is that guy out of jail, by the way?
No. Justin Bieber. No?
He was put in jail when I first started doing comedy, so those were the jokes at that time.
They joked about that?
They joked about
Louima. I tried to come up with some joke about if Louima had a personalized license plate that said plunger or something. Because he made all he made all that money from the incident.
But that was
so
maybe
he could have this big car with the plate.
That's hilarious. That was as close to a full blown Nazi incident as we've ever seen.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Keith Maresca's here.
We're just about out of time, but Keith, I don't know what you want to add to this, or is there something you want to talk about that we haven't spoken about to draw out of Anthony because you know him so well?
Well, it is hard to jump in with this much talent at the table.
Look at that.
There was a lot of good riffing.
Yeah.
If we
were tasering people, he would be a pro.
All my taserings happened right out here.
Yeah.
So they were all great.
One of my favorites was Keith pulled out the taser. And this was at the start of like a lot of these viral YouTube videos. And what did you say to the guy?
I always used to say I'd put the red dot on them and I'd say, you're about 5 seconds away from being a YouTube video. And it would usually get people to calm down.
He mixed up classic police brutality with a new medium.
You're ahead of your time.
Yes.
You know, I get to see a different side of Anthony because I've been with him, not sexually, but you know, working alongside him with Opie and Anthony, and now what we do now since 1999.
Jesus.
And I've heard the story you guys have talked about and everything that's happened with him. And the one thing I think that you know, and you pulled some of it out, but one thing when we have private conversations about it, there's you know, you were asking about how he felt about the whole. As opposed to...
We're talking about Avril Lavigne again?
No, about the specific person. And I think, you know, speaking with him and talking about how it hurt people that we have been friends with for a long time.
Yeah, that's my biggest regret of the whole thing, is that it busted up some amazing relationships that I had had with people over the years. Just amazing comics, people I've laughed with for years, and instantly overnight, it like fucked that whole thing up. And that I'm not blaming anybody but myself for that aspect of it, because I kind of withdrew. Also, I never reached out and tried to talk to a lot of people about this. I'm not that guy. I don't do a lot of this personal talking with people, weirdly enough, because that's my job. But, yeah, I think I could have been more communicative with a lot of my friends to maybe head that off of the best. DeRosa is a prime example.
Me Joe DeRosa.
Me and
about.
Joe DeRosa. Is there another DeRosa?
Well, to our audience, they may not know Joe.
Joe DeRosa, comic, funny guy. I love Joe. And we were on the outs for about a year because of this, because of that event when I got fired from Sirius. And we finally decided to talk on the phone. Within 2 seconds, we were laughing our asses off and calling each other assholes. And, like, the communication thing, and I've always chalked up even the simplest of communication to psychobabble. I'm like, just deal with it. Fuck that. Shut up. It works. Yeah. And I know it really does have some value to it. And I think a lot of peripheral people, internet people and websites and whatnot, chat rooms, Twitter, social media, I think that had a lot of effect because they want to pit you against people. So unless you disavow or say, hey, leave him alone or don't do that, people will read into what other people are saying about you and to other people. So I think there was a big misunderstanding with me and Joe DeRosa about what we felt about what happened. And again, the second we started talking to each other, it was all cool.
Well, I've had that insight as a boss when somebody was fed up and they wanted to quit. And very often I didn't want them to quit. I found that if you would meet with them, once they told you that they're fucking quitting and this is why they're fed up, they're like, okay. You know, as soon as they actually said it, they lose the urge to quit. It's like therapy. You say it, and it disappears.
I think it's so hard for people to actually be face-to-face these days, and it's so valuable. When you talk to someone and look them in the face and actually say what you mean and what you feel, and they give you a rebuttal back or whatever, it's so much different than texting it or putting it on social media. There's a cowardice that comes with that. And if you have to look at someone in the eyes and actually talk to them about a problem, it's not easy to do, first of all, but it's 1,000 times better in the end.
Can I tell you something else? I heard this somewhere recently that there's something called micro expressions, which are the tiniest little things that humans pick up on in another human that we have. It's evolution. We have no idea that we're picking up on them.
Yeah.
And this is what happens when you speak face to face with somebody. You read
something you're never going to get
digitally. You read their
right.
soul. You can read their soul in a way you cannot do from text messages. So this is another reason.
But what about an emoji?
I think text messaging.
Emojis
you could
help.
Send an emoji.
But you know what? It's funny you say that because that is part of the reason probably we rely on emojis.
We need micro emojis.
We need those indicators.
But I think you interpret text messages according to what mood you're in, too. I mean, if you're not feeling good about yourself,
isn't that amazing?
You know, you'll just interpret it as a more hostile
text messaging.
Dude, that's
awesome, because you're not the one changing the context of what the person sent.
That's right.
It's whatever they sent, they sent. That's what they meant. But depending on how you feel, you could read it in a whole nother light. That's fucking the most brilliant thing I've ever heard you say.
Really?
Yeah. But that the
actually,
bar's
not
high.
You didn't let him finish.
Okay. Yeah, fuck it up. Come on.
All right, we're out of time.
I'm
trying to keep it to a solid hour. Listen, unless there's anything else you want to add.
So Keith, you are currently at this time armed. Is that correct?
I am currently.
What's your weapon of choice?
The Bodyguard 380.
Let's say this. He's not too scared about his dick size carrying this gun. It's the smallest little pea shooter.
It's easily concealed.
I think I got it for
your
birthday.
Size.
Not my dick, the gun.
How about Jeff Bezos, huh? This guy not afraid of anybody seeing his dick.
Oh, my God. He loves it.
He's got dick and balls. he is such a hero right now.
Anthony, I shot a gun in Iraq, M4 or whatever it was.
Oh, nice.
I didn't really enjoy it, though. I guess it's just not for me. I guess some people love it.
It's loud.
Well, I could see why you might enjoy it.
It's like fireworks with a kick. It's fun.
I did. I shot an automatic machine gun in Russia at a
Russian
shooting range.
No.
It was awesome. I mean, it's really fun.
It is fun. I even when you see like really hardcore liberals and anti-gun people and stuff, when they get brought to a range and shoot, the first thing they do after the rounds fly out of the barrel, they go, "Oh man!" They're like laughing like mental patients, thinking it was awesome.
By the way,
this is a fun thing.
We have to go. Has anybody pointed out? I thought of a kind of irony in the shower today. Has anybody pointed out the irony that liberals kind of brought? At least accelerated global warming when they went half-cocked against nuclear power in the 70s. Like, if we had actually gone on that trajectory of nuclear power in the 70s, maybe we wouldn't be in this mess.
I was just talking, the cleanest, most efficient energy is nuclear
power. But why don't we have it? Liberals.
Liberals scaring the shit out of everybody that it's going to be an atom bomb going off in your backyard.
And you guys both thought about this when you were in the shower.
I was just thinking of it too.
I was like, why don't we have more nuclear power? Oh, they shut it down. What was that album when we were kids?
No Nukes. It was the No Nukes album with Jackson Brown.
And then the 3 Mile Island.
What was the name of
the movie with Jack Lemmon?
China Syndrome.
China Syndrome.
That was great.
Yeah, so that really shut nuclear power down.
Yeah, and it's pretty safe power source and pretty efficient. But compared
to the end of civilization,
we got to build 8 billion windmills somewhere.
And now all the insects are dying. It's kind of scary. I mean, I have kids. I'm worried about it. Anyway, I haven't been stung by
a bee in years.
So Anthony, thank you very much.
Thank you, man. Awesome.
I hope it was all right.
Absolutely. Please. I had a blast.
And that's it. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.